Side 8, The Ruby Knight, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 336. Sparhawk was about to protest, but the Patriarch raised one thick hand. He looked at the hulking Pelosian.
Okuda, he said sternly, you were once a monk?
I was, Your Grace.
Good. This shall be your penance, then. You will resume your monk's habit, Brother Okuda, and you will enter my service. When I have decided that you have paid for your sin, I will grant you absolution.
Your Grace,
Okuda sobbed, falling to his knees.
How can I ever thank you?
Bergson smiled bleakly.
You may change your mind in time, Brother Okuda. You will find that I'm a very hard master. You'll pay for your sin many times over before your soul is washed clean. Now, go gather your possessions. You'll be moving in here with me.
Yes, Your Grace.
Okuda rose and left the tent.
If you don't mind my saying so, Your Grace, Sparhawk said, you are a very devious man.
No, not really, Sir Sparhawk. The huge churchman smiled. It's just that I've had enough experience to know that the human spirit is a very complex thing. Your friend feels that he must suffer in order to expiate his sin, and if I were simply to absolve him, he would always doubt that he had been thoroughly cleansed. He feels that he has to suffer, so I'll make sure that he suffers. In moderation, of course. I'm not a monster, after all.
Was what he did really a sin?
Of course not. He acted out of mercy. He'll make a very good monk. And after I think he's suffered long enough, I'll find a nice quiet monastery someplace and make him the abbot. He'll be too busy to brood about things, and the church will get a good, faithful abbot. This is not to mention all those years when I'll have his services at no cost.
You're not really a very nice man, Your Grace.
I have never pretended to be, my son.
That will be all, Sir Sparhawk. Go with my blessing.
The Patriarch winked slyly.
Thank you, Your Grace, Sparhawk said, without cracking a smile.
He felt somehow very pleased with himself as he and the sentry walked back across the camp. He might not always be able to solve his own problems, but he certainly seemed able to solve those of others.
Kring was telling us that the outside of the camp is being patrolled, Tinian said when Sparhawk re-entered the tent.
That's going to make it more difficult to get away, isn't it?
Much more, Sparhawk agreed.
Oh, Tinian added. Flute's been asking some questions about distances. Keurig looked in the packs, but he couldn't find your map.
It's in my saddlebag.
I should have thought of that, I suppose, Keurig said.
What is it you want to know?
Sparhawk asked the little girl, opening his saddlebag for the map.
How far is it from this Agnic place to Asye?
Sparhawk spread his map out on the table in the center of the pavilion.
It's a very pretty picture, but it doesn't answer my question, she said.
Sparhawk measured it off.
It's about 300 leagues, he replied.
That still doesn't answer my question, Sparhawk. I need to know how long it will take.
He computed it.
About 20 days.
She frowned.
Perhaps I can shorten that a bit, she said.
What are we talking about here? He asked her.
Asier's on the coast, isn't it?
Yes.
We're going to need a boat to get us to Thalesia. Gwerig's taking Beliom to his cave up in the mountains there.
There are enough of us to overpower the sentries, Colton said, and dealing with a patrol in the middle of the night's not all that hard.
We're still not so far behind Gwerig that we can't catch him. We have something to do in Asier, she told him. At least I do. And it must be done before we go after Beliom. We know where Gwerig's going, so he won't be hard to find. Euleth, go tell Worgen that we'll accompany him to Asye. Think up some plausible reason.
Yes, lady, he said with the faintest hint of a smile.
I wish you'd all stop doing that, she complained. Oh, by the way, on your way to Worgen's tent, ask someone to bring us some supper.
What would you like?
Goat would be nice, but anything will do as long as it's not pork.
They reached Agnek just before sunset the following day and set up their huge camp. The local citizenry immediately closed the city gates. King Worgen insisted that Sparhawk and the other church knights accompany him under a flag of truce to the north gate.
"I am Worgen of Thalesia," he roared at the city walls. "I have King Soros of Pelosia with me, as well as these knights of the church. The kingdom of Arsham has been invaded by the Rendors, and I call upon every able-bodied man with faith in God to join with us in our efforts to stamp out the Ashandist heresy. I'm not here to inconvenience you in any way, my friends, but if that gate isn't open by the time the sun goes down, I'll reduce your walls to rubble and drive you all into the wilderness, where you can watch your city burn down to ashes."
"Do you think they heard him?" Colton asked. "They probably heard him in Kyrelos," Tinian replied. "Your king has a most penetrating voice, Sir Euleth."
"It's a long way from one mountaintop to another in Thalesia," Euleth shrugged. "You have to talk very loud if you want to be heard."
King Worgen grinned crookedly at him.
"Would anyone care to wager on whether or not that gate opens before the sun slips behind yon hill?" he asked.
"We are church knights, Your Majesty," Bavia replied piously.
"We take a vow of poverty, so we're not really in a position to gamble on sporting events." King Worgen roared with laughter. The city gate opened somewhat hesitantly.
"Somehow I knew they'd see it my way," Worgen said, leading the way into the city. "Where will I find your chief magistrate?" he asked one of the trembling gate guards.
I believe he's in the council house, Your Majesty," the guard stammered. "Probably hiding in the cellar."
"Be a good fellow and go fetch him for me."
"At once, Your Majesty."
The guard threw down his pike and ran off down the street.
"I like Lamerks," Worgen said expansively. "They're always so eager to be obliging."
The chief magistrate was a pudgy man. His face was pale and he was sweating profusely as the gate guard bodily dragged him into Worgen's presence.
"I will require suitable quarters for King Soros, myself, and our entourage, Your Excellency," Worgen informed him. "This won't inconvenience your citizens all that much, because they'll be up all night equipping themselves for an extended military campaign anyway."
"As Your Majesty commands,"
the magistrate replied in a squeaky voice.
"You see what I mean about Lamerks," Worgen said. "Soros will have smooth going down here. He'll sweep the whole kingdom clean in a week, if he doesn't stop to pray too often. Why don't we go someplace and get something to drink while His Excellency here empties a dozen or so houses for us?"
After a consultation with King Soros and Patriarch Bergsten the following morning, Worgen took a troop of Thalesian cavalry and led them toward the west with Sparhawk riding at his side. It was a fine morning. The sunlight sparkled on the lake and there was a light breeze blowing in from the west.
"I suppose you're still not going to tell me what you were doing in Pelosia," Worgen said to Sparhawk.
The Thalesian king seemed relatively sober this morning, so Sparhawk decided to risk his mood. "You know about Queen Alana's illness, of course," he began.
"The whole world knows about it. That's why her bastard cousin is trying to seize power."
"There's a bit more to it than that, Your Majesty.
We've finally isolated the cause of the illness. Primate Annius needed access to her treasury, so he had her poisoned."
"He did what?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"Annius is not overburdened with scruples, and he'll do anything to reach the archprelacy."
"The man's a scoundrel," Worgen growled.
"At any rate, we've discovered a possible cure for Alana. It involves the use of magic, and we need a certain talisman to make it work. We found out that the talisman is in Lake Venny."
"What is this talisman?" Worgen asked, his eyes narrowed.
"It's a kind of an ornament," Sparhawk replied evasively.
"Do you really put that much store in all that magic nonsense?"
"I've seen it work a few times, Your Majesty. Anyhow, that's why we objected so much when you insisted that we join you. We weren't trying to be disrespectful. Alana's life is being sustained by a spell, but it's only good for just so long. If she dies, Lycaeus will take the throne."
"Not if I can help it, he won't. I don't want any throne in Eosia occupied by a man who doesn't know his own father."
"The idea doesn't appeal to me either. But I think Lycaeus does in fact know who his father is."
"Oh? Who is it? Do you know?"
"The primate Annius."
Worgen's eyes went wide.
Are you sure of that?
Sparhawk nodded.
I have it on the very best authority. The ghost of King Aldreus told me. His sister was a bit profligate.
Worgen made the sign to ward off evil, a peasant gesture that looked peculiar coming from a reigning monarch.
A ghost, you say? The word of a ghost won't stand up in any court, Sparhawk.
I wasn't planning to take it to court, Your Majesty, Sparhawk said grimly, resting his hand on his sword hilt. As soon as I have the leisure, the principals will be standing before a higher judgment.
Good man, Worgen approved.
I wouldn't have thought that a churchman would have succumbed to Arissa, though.
Arissa can be very persuasive sometimes.
Anyway, this campaign of yours is directed at another one of Annius' plots. I strongly suspect that the Renderish invasion is being led by a man named Martell. Martell works for Annius, and he's been trying to stir up enough trouble to draw the church knights away from Kyrillos during the election. Our preceptors could probably keep Annius off the archprelate's throne, so he had to get them out of his way.
The man's a real snake, isn't he?
That's a pretty fair description.
You've given me a lot to think about this morning, Sparhawk. I'll mull it over and we'll talk some more about it later.
A sudden light sprang into Sparhawk's eyes.
Don't get your hopes up too much, though. I still think I'm going to need you when I get to Arsham. Besides, the militant orders have already marched south. You're Vanion's right arm, and I think he'd miss you if you stayed away.
Time and distance seemed to drag on interminably as they rode west. They crossed into Pelosia again and rode across the unending plains in bright summer sunlight. One night, when they were still some distance from the border of Deira, Calton was in a bad humor.
I thought you said you were going to speed this trip up, he said accusingly to Flute.
I did,
she replied.
Really?
He said with heavy sarcasm.
We've been on the road for a week already, and we haven't even reached Deira yet.
Actually, Calton, we've only been on the road for 2 days. I have to make it seem longer so that Worgen doesn't get suspicious.
He looked at her disbelievingly.
I've got another question for you, Flute, Tinian said. Back at the lake, you were very eager to catch Gwerig and take Beliom away from him. Then you suddenly changed your mind and said that we have to go to Assier. What happened?
I received word from my family, she told him. They told me about this task I have to complete at Assier before we can go after Beliom.
She made a wry face.
I probably would have thought of it myself.
Let's get back to this other thing, Calton said impatiently.
How did you squeeze time together the way you said you have?
There are ways, she said evasively.
I wouldn't pursue it, Calton, Sophronia advised. You wouldn't understand what she's been doing, so why worry about it?
Besides, if you keep asking her questions, she might decide to answer you, and the answers would probably upset you very much.
Chapter 22 It seemed that it took them 2 more weeks to reach the foothills above Assier, the bleak, ugly capital of Deira, which perched on an eroded bluff overlooking the original harbor and the long, narrow gulf of Assier. Flute advised them that evening, however, that no more than 5 days had passed since they had left the city of Agnic in Lamarkand. Most of them chose to take her at her word, but Sir Bavier, who was of a scholarly and resolutely Elanian frame of mind, questioned her about how this seeming miracle had come to pass. Her explanation was patient, although dreadfully obscure. Bavier finally excused himself and went outside the tent for a time to look at the stars and to reestablish his relations with things he had always considered immutable and eternal.
"Did you understand anything she said at all?" Tinian asked him when he returned, pale and sweating, to the tent.
"A little," Bavier replied, sitting down again. "Just around the edges." He looked at Flute with frightened eyes.
I think perhaps that Patriarch Orzel was right. We should have no dealings with these Styric people. Nothing is sacred to them.
Flute crossed the tent on her grass-stained little feet and laid a consoling hand on his cheek.
Dear Bavier, she said sweetly, so serious and so devout. We must get to Thalesia quickly, just as soon as I can finish what I have to do in Assier. We simply did not have the time to plod halfway across the continent at the usual pace. That's why I did it the other way.
I understand the reasons, he said, but
I will never hurt you, you know, and I won't let anybody else hurt you either. But you must try not to be so rigid. It makes it so very hard to explain things to you. Does that help at all?
Not appreciably. She raised up on her tiptoes and kissed him.
Now then, she said brightly, everything's all right again, isn't it?
He gave up. Do as you will, Flute, he said to her with a gentle, almost shy smile. I can't refute your arguments and your kisses at the same time.
He's such a nice boy, she said delightedly to the others.
We sort of feel the same way about him ourselves, Euleth said blandly, and we have some plans for him.
You, however, she said critically to the Genidian knight, are most definitely not a nice boy.
I know, he admitted unruffled, and you have no idea how much that disappointed my mother, and a number of other ladies from time to time as well. She gave him a dark look and stalked away, muttering to herself in Styric. Sparhawk recognized some of the words, and he wondered if she really knew what they meant. As had become his custom, Morgan asked Sparhawk to ride beside him the following morning as they trekked down the long rocky slope from the foothills of the Dayuran Mountains toward the coast.
I should really get out more often, the King of Thalesia confided. After almost 3 weeks coming from Agnek, I should be nearly ready to fall out of my saddle. But I feel as if we've been on the road for only a few days.
Perhaps it was the mountains, Sparhawk suggested carefully. Mountain air is always invigorating.
Maybe that's it, Worgen agreed.
Have you given any more thought to the discussion we had a while back, Your Majesty? Sparhawk asked cautiously.
I've had a lot on my mind, Sparhawk. I appreciate your personal concern about Queen Alana, but from a political standpoint, the important thing now is to crush this Renderish invasion. Then the preceptors of the militant orders will be able to return to Kyrelos and block the Primate of Cimera. If Ennius fails to gain the archprelacy, Lycaeus the Bastard won't have any chance of ascending the throne of Elenia. I realize that it's a hard choice, but politics is a hard game.
A little later, when Worgen was conferring with his troop commander, Sparhawk relayed the gist of their conversation to his companions.
He's not any more reasonable when he's sober, is he? Calton said.
From his own standpoint, he's right, though, Tinian observed. The politics of the situation dictate that we do everything we can to get all the preceptors back to Kyrelos before Clavonus dies. I doubt that he cares much one way or the other about Alana. There's one other possibility, though. We're in Deira now, and Obler's the king here. He's a very wise old man. If we explain the situation to him, he might overrule Worgen.
I don't think I'd care to hang Alana's life on that slim a possibility, Sparhawk said.
He turned to rejoin Worgen. Despite Flute's assurances concerning the actual elapsed time their journey had consumed, Sparhawk was still impatient. The apparent slow pace nagged at him. While he could intellectually accept what she said, he could not come to grips with it emotionally. 20 days is 20 days to one's senses, and Sparhawk's senses were strung wire taut just now. He began to have dark thoughts. Things had been going wrong so consistently that seeming premonitions tugged at his mind. He began to think about the forthcoming encounter with Gwerig with a great deal less certainty about the outcome. About noon they reached Asie, the capital city of the Kingdom of Deira. The Deiran army was encamped around the city, and their camp was bustling with activity as they prepared for the march south. Worgen had been drinking again, but he looked around with satisfaction.
Good, he said. They're almost ready. Come along, Sparhawk, and bring your friends. Let's go talk to Obler.
As they rode through the narrow, cobbled streets of Asie, Talon pulled his horse in beside Sparhawk's.
I'm going to drop behind a ways, he said very quietly. I want to look around. Getting away in the open countryside's very hard. This is a town, though, and there are always lots of places to hide in towns. King Worgen's not going to miss me. He hardly knows I'm along. If I can find us a good hiding place, maybe we can slip away to it and stay there until the army moves out. Then we can make a run for Thalesia.
Just be very careful.
Naturally.
A few streets farther on, Sophrania reined in sharply and pulled her white palfrey off to the side of the street. She and Flute quickly dismounted and went to the entrance of a narrow alley to greet an aged Styric with a long snowy beard
who wore an intensely white robe. Some sort of ritual ceremony seemed to take place among the three of them, but Sparhawk could not quite make out the details. Sophronia and Flute spoke earnestly to the old man at some length, and then he bowed in acknowledgement and went back on up the alley.
"What was all that about?" Worgen asked suspiciously when Sophronia and the little girl rejoined them.
"He's an old friend, Your Majesty," Sophronia replied, "and the most revered and wise man in all of Western Styricum."
"A king, you mean?"
"That's a word that has no meaning in Styricum, Your Majesty," she told him.
"How can you have a government if you don't have a king?"
"There are other ways, Your Majesty. And besides, Styrix has outgrown the need for government."
"That's absurd."
"Many things seem that way, at first. It may come to Yuelines in time."
"That's a very infuriating woman sometimes, Sparhawk," Worgen growled, pushing his horse back to the front of the column.
"Sparhawk," Flute said very lightly.
"Yes?"
"The task here in Ossier is complete. We can leave for Thalesia at any time now."
"How do you propose to manage that?"
"I'll tell you later. Go keep Worgen company. He gets lonesome without you." The palace was not a particularly imposing building. It looked to be more like a complex of administrative offices than something built for ostentation and display.
"I don't know how Obler can live in this hovel," Worgen said disdainfully, swaying in his saddle. "You there," he bellowed at one of the guards posted at the main door. "Go tell Obler that Worgen of Thalesia has arrived. We need to confer about a few things."
"At once, Your Majesty."
The guard saluted and went inside. Worgen dismounted and unhooked the wineskin from the skirt of his saddle. He uncorked it and took a long drink.
"I hope Obler's got some chilled ale," he said. "This wine's beginning to sour my stomach."
The guard returned.
"King Obler will receive you, Your Majesty," he said. "Please follow me."
"I know the way," Worgen replied. "I've been here before. Have somebody see to our horses."
He blinked his bloodshot eyes at Sparhawk.
"Come along, then," he commanded.
He did not appear to have missed Talon. They trooped through the unadorned hallways of King Obler's palace and found the aged King of Deira sitting behind a large table littered with maps and papers.
"Sorry to be so late, Obler," Worgen said, untying his purple cloak and dropping it on the floor. "I made a swing through Pelosia to pick up Soros and a sort of an army."
He sprawled out in a chair.
"I've been sort of out of touch. What's been going on?"
"The Rendors have laid siege to Larium," the white-haired King of Deira replied. "The Alcyonies, Genidians, and Cyrenix are holding the city, and the Pandions are out in the countryside dealing with Rendorish raiding parties."
"That's more or less what I'd expected," Worgen grunted. "Can you send for some ale, Obler? My stomach's been bothering me for the past few days. You remember Sparhawk, don't you?"
"Of course. He's the man who saved Count Radin down in Arsham."
"And this one is Calton. The big one there is Euleth. The one with the dark skin is Bavier, and I'm sure you know Tinian. The Styric woman is called Sophronia. I'm not really sure about her real name. I'm sure neither one of us could even pronounce it. She teaches the Pandion's magic, and that adorable child there is her little girl. The other two work for Sparhawk. I wouldn't aggravate either one of them."
He looked around, his eyes bleary.
"What happened to that boy you had with you?" he asked Sparhawk. "Probably exploring," Sparhawk replied blandly. "Political discussions bore him." "Sometimes they bore me as well," Worgen said.
He looked back at King Obler.
"Have the Alines mobilized yet?"
"My agents have found no evidence of it."
Worgen started to swear.
"I think I'll stop in Simera on my way south and hang that young bastard Lycaeus."
"I'll lend you a rope, Your Majesty," Calton offered.
Worgen laughed.
"What's happening in Kyrelos, Obler?"
"Clivonus is in delirium," Obler replied. "He can't last much longer, I'm afraid. Most of the major churchmen are already there preparing for the election of his successor."
"The primate of Simera, most likely," Worgen growled sourly.
He took a tankard of ale from a servant.
"That's all right, boy," he said. "Just leave the keg."
His voice was slurred.
This is the way I see it, Ubler. We'd better get to Larium as quickly as we can. We'll push the Rendors back into the sea so that the militant orders can go to Kyrelos and keep Anias from becoming archprelate. If that happens, we may have to declare war.
On the church?
Ubler sounded startled.
Archprelates have been deposed before, Ubler. Anias won't have any use for a mitre if he doesn't have a head. Sparhawk has already volunteered to use his knife.
You'll start a general civil war, Worgen. No one has directly confronted the church for centuries.
Then maybe it's about time. Anything else happening?
The Earl of Lenda and Preceptor Vanion of the Pandion Order arrived no more than an hour ago, Ubler said. They wanted to get cleaned up. I sent for them just as soon as I'd heard that you'd arrived. They'll join us in a bit.
Good. We'll be able to settle a lot of things here, then. What's the date?
King Ubler told him.
Your calendar must be wrong, Ubler, Worgen said after counting days off on his fingers.
What did you do with Soros?
Ubler asked.
I came close to killing him, Worgen growled. I've never seen anybody pray so much when there was work to be done. I sent him into Lamarkan to pick up the barons down there. He's riding at the head of the army, but Bergsten's actually the one in charge.
Bergsten would make a good archprelate if we could ever get him out of that armor. He laughed.
Can you imagine the reaction of the hierocracy to an archprelate in a mail shirt and a horned helmet with a battle axe in his hands?
It might enliven the church a bit, Worgen, Ubler conceded with a faint smile.
God knows she needs it, Worgen said. She's been acting like a frigid old maid since Clavonus fell ill.
Would your majesties excuse me? Sparhawk asked deferentially. I'd like to look in on Vanion. We haven't seen each other for a while, and there are things I need to report to him.
More of this everlasting church business? Worgen asked.
You know how it is, Your Majesty.
No, thank God, I don't. Go ahead, Knight of the Church. Talk with your Father Superior, but don't keep him too long. We've got important business here.
Yes, Your Majesty. Sparhawk bowed to the two kings and quietly left the room. Vanion was trying to struggle into his armor when Sparhawk entered the room. He stared at his subordinate in some astonishment.
What are you doing here, Sparhawk? He demanded. I thought you were in Lamarkand.
Just passing through, Vanion, Sparhawk replied. Some things have changed. I'll give you the gist of it now, and we can fill you in on more detail after King Worgen goes to bed. He looked critically at his preceptor.
You're looking tired, my friend.
Old age, Vanion said ruefully, and all of those swords I made Sophronia give me are getting heavier every day.
You know that Olvan died?
Yes. His ghost brought his sword to Sophronia.
I was afraid of that. I'll take it away from her.
Sparhawk tapped Vanion's breastplate with one knuckle.
You don't have to wear this, you know. Obler's fairly informal, and Worgen doesn't even know what the word formal means.
Appearances, my friend, Vanion said, and the honor of the church. Sometimes it's boring, I'll admit, but... He shrugged.
Help me into this contraption, Sparhawk. You can talk while you're tightening straps and buckling buckles.
Yes, my lord Vanion. Sparhawk began to assist his friend into the suit of armor, briefly summarizing the events that had taken place in Lamarkand and Pelosia.
Why didn't you chase down the troll? Vanion asked him.
Some things came up, Sparhawk said, fastening Vanion's black cape to his shoulder plates. Worgen, for one thing. I even offered to fight him, but Patriarch Bergsten interfered.
You challenged a king?
Vanion looked stunned.
It seemed appropriate at the time, Vanion.
Oh, my friend... Vanion sighed.
We'd better get going, Sparhawk said. There's a lot more to tell you, but Worgen's getting impatient.
Sparhawk squinted at Vanion's armor.
Brace yourself, he said. You're lopsided.
Then he banged both of his fists down on Vanion's shoulder plates.
There, he said. That's better.
Thanks, Vanion said dryly, his knees buckling slightly.
The honor of the order, my lord. I don't want you to look as if you were dressed in cheap tin plates.
Vanion decided not to answer that. The Earl of Lenda was in the room when Sparhawk and Vanion entered.
There you are, Vanion, King Worgen said. Now we can get started. What's happening down in Arsham?
The situation hasn't changed all that much, Your Majesty. The Rendors are still besieging Larium, but the Genidians, Cyrenix, and Alcyones are inside the walls along with most of the Arshan army.
Is the city in any real danger?
Hardly. It's built like a mountain. You know the Arshan fondness for stonework. It could probably hold out for 20 years. Vanion looked over at Sparhawk. I saw an old friend of yours down there, he said. Martell appears to be in command of the Rendorish army.
I'd sort of guessed that.
I thought I'd nailed his feet to the floor down in Rendor, but apparently he managed to talk his way around Arashim.
He really didn't have to, King Obra said. Arashim died a month ago, under highly suspicious circumstances.
It sounds as if Martell's had his hand in the poison jar again, Colton said. Who's the new spiritual leader in Rendor, then? Sparhawk asked.
A man named Ulysim, King Obler replied. I gather he was one of Arashim's disciples.
Sparhawk laughed.
Arashim didn't even know he existed.
I've met Ulysim. The man's an idiot. He won't last 6 months. Anyway, Vanion continued, I have the Pandion Order out in the countryside dealing with Renderish foraging parties. Martell's going to start getting hungry before long. That's about all, Your Majesty, he concluded.
Nice and to the point. Thanks, Vanion. Lenda, what's going on in Cimera?
Things are about the same, Your Majesty, except that Aeneas has gone to Kyrelos.
And he's probably perched on the foot of the archprelate's bed like a vulture, Worgen surmised.
I wouldn't be at all surprised, Your Majesty, Lenda agreed. He left Lycaeus in charge. I have a number of people in the palace who work for me, and one of them managed to hear Aeneas giving Lycaeus his final instructions. He ordered Lycaeus to withhold the Elanian army from the campaign in Rendor. As soon as Clavonus dies, the army, and the church soldiers in Cimera, are supposed to march on Kyrelos. Aeneas wants to flood the holy city with his own men to help intimidate the uncommitted members of the hierocracy.
The Elanian army is mobilized, then?
Fully, Your Majesty. They have an encampment about 10 leagues south of Cimera.
We'll probably have to fight them, Your Majesty, Colton said. Aeneas dismissed most of the old generals and replaced them with men loyal to him.
Worgen started to swear.
It may not be quite as serious as it sounds, Your Majesty, the Earl of Lenda said. I've made an extended study of the law. In times of religious crisis, the militant orders are empowered to take command of all forces in Western Aeosia. Wouldn't you say that an invasion by the Ashandist heresy qualifies as a religious crisis?
By God, you're right, Lenda. Is that Elanian law?
No, Your Majesty. Church law.
Worgen suddenly howled with laughter.
Oh, that's too rare, he roared, pounding on the arm of his chair with one beefy fist. Aeneas is trying to become the head of the church, and we use church law to spike his wheel. Lenda, you're a genius.
I have my moments, Your Majesty, Lenda replied modestly. I'd imagine that Preceptor Vanion here can persuade the general staff to join your forces, particularly in view of the fact that church law empowers him to resort to extreme measures should any officer refuse to accept his authority in such situations.
I'd imagine that a few beheadings might prove instructional to the general staff, Ewoth said. If we shorten 4 or 5 generals, the rest will probably fall in line.
Quickly, Tinian added with a grin.
Keep your axe good and sharp, then, Ewoth. Worgen said.
Yes, Your Majesty. About the only problem remaining is what we're going to do about Lycaeus, the Earl of Lenda said.
I've already decided that, Worgen said. As soon as we get to Cimera, I'm going to hang him.
Splendid notion, Lenda said smoothly. But I think we might want to consider that just a bit. You do know that Aeneas is the Prince Regent's father, don't you?
So Sparhawk tells me, but I don't really care who his father is. I'm going to hang him anyway.
I'm not really sure just how fond Aeneas is of his son, but he did go to some fairly extreme measures to put him on the Elanian throne. It might just be that the militant orders can use him to some advantage when they get to Kyrelos. An offer to put him to the torture might just persuade Aeneas to move his troops out of Kyrelos so that the election can proceed without their interference.
You're taking all the fun out of this, Lenda,
Worgen complained. He scowled.
You're probably right, though. All right, when we get to Simera, we'll throw him in the dungeon, along with all his toadies. Are you up to taking charge at the palace?
If your majesty wishes, Lenda sighed. But wouldn't Sparhawk or Vanion be a better choice?
Maybe, but I'm going to need them when I get to Arsham. What do you think, Obler?
I have absolute confidence in the Earl of Lenda, King Obler replied.
I'll do my best, your majesties, Lenda said. But keep in mind the fact that I'm getting very old.
You're not as old as I am, my friend, King Obler reminded him, and nobody's offered to let me evade my responsibilities. All right, that's settled then, Worgen said. Now let's get down to cases. We'll march south to Simera, imprison Lycaeus, and bully the Alanian general staff into joining us with their army. We may as well pick up the church soldiers as well. Then we join Soros and Bergston on the Arshan border. We march south to Larium and circle the Rendors and exterminate the lot of them.
Isn't that a bit extreme, Your Majesty? Lenda objected.
No, as a matter of fact, it's not. I want it to be at least 10 generations before the Ashandist heresy raises its head again.
He grinned crookedly at Sparhawk.
If you serve well and faithfully, my friend, I'll even let you kill Martell.
I'd appreciate that, Your Majesty, Sparhawk replied politely.
Oh, dear, Sophrania sighed.
It needs to be done, little lady, Worgen told her. Obler, is your army ready to move?
They're only awaiting orders, Worgen.
Good. If you don't have anything else planned, why don't we start for Alania tomorrow?
We might as well, old King Obler shrugged.
Worgen stood up and stretched, yawning broadly.
Let's all get some sleep, then, he said. We'll be starting early tomorrow.
Later, Sparhawk and his friends gathered in Vanion's room to tell the preceptor in much greater detail what had happened in Lamarkand and Pelosia. When they had finished, Vanion looked curiously at Flute.
Just exactly what's your part in all this? He asked her.
I was sent to help,
she replied with a shrug.
By Styricum?
In a manner of speaking.
And what is this task you have to perform here in Assier?
I've already done it, Vanion. Sophrania and I had to talk with a certain Styric here. We saw him in the street on our way to the palace and took care of it.
What did you have to say to him that was more important than getting the Belium?
We had to prepare Styricum for what is about to happen.
The invasion by the Rendors, you mean?
Oh, that's nothing, Vanion. This is much, much more serious.
Vanion looked at Sparhawk. You're going to Thalesia, then? Sparhawk nodded. Even if I have to walk on water to get there. All right, I'll do what I can to help you get out of the city. There's one thing that concerns me, though. If you all leave, Worgen's going to notice that you're gone. Sparhawk and one or two others might be able to get away without alerting Worgen, but that's about all. Flute stepped into the middle of the room and looked them over.
Sparhawk, she said, pointing, and Curic, Sophrania and me, and Talon.
That's absurd! Xavier
exploded.
Sparhawk's going to need knights with him if he's going to come up against Gwerig.
Sparhawk and Curic can take care of it, she said complacently.
Isn't it dangerous to take Flute along? Vanion asked Sparhawk.
Maybe, but she's the only one who knows the way to Gwerig's cave. Why Talon? Curic said to Flute.
There's something he has to do in Emsat, she replied.
I'm sorry, my friends, Sparhawk told the other knights. But we're more or less committed to doing things her way.
Are you going to leave now? Vanion said.
No. We have to wait for Talon.
Good.
Sophrania, go get Olvan's sword.
But...
Just do it, Sophrania. Please don't argue with me.
Yes, dear one.
After she had delivered Olvan's sword to him, Vanion was so weak he could barely stand.
You're going to kill yourself doing this, you know, she told him.
Everybody dies from something.
Now then, gentlemen, he said to the knights, I have a troop of Pandions with me. Those of you who are staying behind should mingle yourselves in among them when we ride out. Lenda and Obler are both quite old. I'll suggest to Worgen that we put them in a carriage and that he ride along with them. That should keep him from being able to count noses.
I'll try to keep him occupied. He looked at Sparhawk. A day or two is probably all I'll be able to manage for you, he apologized. That should be enough, Sparhawk said. Worgen's likely to think that I'm going back to Lake Venny. He'll send any pursuit in that direction. The only problem now is getting you out of the palace.
I'll take care of that, Luke told him.
How?
Magic,
she said, comically drawing the word out and wiggling her fingers at him. He laughed. How did we ever get along without you? She sniffed.
Badly, I'd imagine.
It was about an hour later when Talon slipped into the room. Any problems? Keurig asked him.
No, Talon shrugged. I made a few contacts and found us a place to hide.
Contacts? Vanyon asked him.
With whom? A few thieves, some beggars, and a couple of murderers. They sent me to the man who controls the underside of Asier. He owes Platymie a few favors, so when I mentioned Platymie's name, he became very helpful.
You live in a strange world, Talon, Vanyon said.
No stranger than the one you live in, my lord, Talon said with an extravagant bow.
That may be entirely true, Sparhawk, Vanyon said. We may all be thieves and brigands when you get right down to it. All right, he said to Talon. Where is this hiding place?
I'd rather not say, Talon replied evasively. You're sort of an official person, and I gave my word.
There's honor in your profession?
Oh, yes, my lord.
It's not based on any knightly code, though. It's based on not getting your throat cut. You have a very wise son, Keurig, Coulton said.
You had to go ahead and say it, didn't you, Coulton?
Keurig asked acidly.
Are you ashamed of me, father?
Talon asked in a small voice, his face downcast. Keurig looked at him. No, Talon, he said.
Actually, I'm not.
He put his burly arm about the boy's shoulders.
This is my son, Talon, he said defiantly. And if anybody wants to make an issue of it, I'll be more than happy to give him satisfaction. And we can throw out the nonsense about the nobility and the commons not being allowed to fight each other.
Don't be absurd, Keurig, Tinian said with a broad grin. Congratulations to you both. The other knights gathered about the husky squire and his larcenous son, clapping them on the shoulders and adding their congratulations to Tinian's. Talon looked around at them, his eyes suddenly very wide and filled with tears at his sudden acknowledgement. Then he fled to Sophronia, fell to his knees, buried his face in her lap, and wept. Flute smiled. Chapter 23 It was that same peculiarly drowsy melody Flute had played on the docks at Vardanias, and again outside the chapter house in Simera.
What's she doing now?
Talon whispered to Sparhawk as they all crouched behind the balustrade of the white porch at the front of King Obler's palace. She's putting Worgen's sentries to sleep, Sparhawk replied. There was no point in extended explanations. They'll ignore us as we pass them. Sparhawk wore his mail shirt and his traveler's cloak.
Are you sure about that?
Talon sounded dubious. I've seen it work a few times before. Flute stood up and walked to the wide staircase leading down to the courtyard. Still holding her pipes in one hand, she motioned for them to follow with the other.
Let's go, Sparhawk said, rising to his feet.
Sparhawk, Talon warned, you're right out in plain sight.
It's all right, Talon. They won't pay any attention to us.
You mean they can't see us?
They can see us, Sophronia told the boy, at least with their eyes. But our presence doesn't mean anything to them. Sparhawk led them to the stairs, and they followed Flute on down into the yard. One of the Thalesian soldiers was posted at the foot of the stairs, and he gave them no more than a glance as they passed, his eyes dull and uninterested.
This is very hard on my nerves, you know, Talon whispered.
You don't have to whisper, Talon, Sophronia told him.
They can't hear us either?
They can hear us all right, but our voices don't register on them.
You wouldn't mind if I got ready to run anyhow, would you?
It's not really necessary.
I'll do it all the same.
Relax, Talon, Sophronia said. You're making it harder for Flute. They went into the stables, saddled their horses, and led them out into the courtyard as Flute continued to play her pipes. Then they walked out through the gate, past King Obler's indifferent sentries and King Worgen's patrol in the street outside the palace.
"Which way?" Kurek asked his son.
"That alley just down the street."
"Is this place very far?"
"About halfway across town. Malin doesn't like to get too close to the palace because the streets around here are patrolled."
"Malin?"
"Our host. He controls all the thieves and beggars here in Asie."
"Is he dependable?"
"Of course not, Kurek. He's a thief. He won't betray us, though. I asked for Thieves' Sanctuary. He's obliged to take us in and hide us from anybody who might come looking for us. If he had refused, he'd have had to answer to Platamy at the next meeting of the Thieves' Council in Kyrelos."
"There's a whole world out there that we don't know anything about,"
Kurek said to Sparhawk.
"I've noticed," Sparhawk replied.
The boy led them through the crooked streets of Asie to a shabby section not too far from the city gates.
"Stay here,"
he said when they reached a seedy-looking tavern. He went inside and emerged a moment later with a ferret-like man.
"He's going to take care of our horses."
"Watch out for this one, neighbor," Sparhawk warned the fellow as he handed him Farron's reins. "He's playful." "Farron, behave yourself."
Farron flicked his ears irritably as Sparhawk carefully pulled the spear of Aldreas out from under his saddle skirt. Talon led them into the tavern. It was lighted by smoky tallow candles and had long, scarred tables flanked by rickety-looking benches. There were a number of rough-looking men sitting at the tables. None of them paid any particular attention to Sparhawk and his friends, though their eyes were busy. Talon went to a stairway at the back.
"It's up here,"
he said, pointing up the stairs. The loft at the top of the stairs was very large, and it looked oddly familiar to Sparhawk. It was sparsely furnished, and there were straw pallets on the floor along the walls. It seemed somehow very similar to Platamy's cellar back in Cimera. Mayland was a thin man with an evil-looking scar running down his left cheek. He was sitting at a table with a sheet of paper and an inkpot in front of him. There was a heap of jewelry near his left hand, and he seemed to be cataloguing the pieces.
"Mayland," Talon said as they approached the table, "these are the friends I told you about."
"I thought you said there would be 10 of you."
Mayland had a nasal, unpleasant voice.
"The plans have changed. This is Sparhawk. He's the one who's more or less in charge."
Mayland grunted.
"How long do you plan to be here?"
he asked Sparhawk shortly.
"If I can find a ship, only until tomorrow morning." "You shouldn't have any trouble finding a ship. There are ships from all over Western Aeosia down at the harbor. Thalesian, Arshan, Alanian, and even a few from Camoria."
"Are the city gates open at night?"
"Not usually, but there's that army camped outside the walls. The soldiers are going in and out of town, so the gates are open."
Mayland looked critically at the knight.
"If you're going to the harbor, you'd better not wear that mail, or the sword. Talon says that you'd prefer not to be noticed. The people down there would remember someone dressed the way you are. There are some clothes hanging on those pegs over there. Find something that fits."
Malin's tone was abrupt.
"What's the best way to get down to the harbor?"
"Go out the north gate. There's a wagon track that leads down to the water. It branches off the main road on the left about a half mile out of town."
"Thank you, neighbor," Sparhawk said.
Mayland grunted and went back to his catalog.
"Kurek and I are going to go down to the harbor to see about a ship," Sparhawk told Sophronia. "You'd better stay here with the children."
"As you wish," she said.
Sparhawk found a somewhat shabby blue doublet hanging on one of the pegs that looked as if it might fit. He took off his mail shirt and sword and put it on. Then he pulled on his cloak again.
"Where are all of your people?"
Talon was asking Mayland.
"It's night time," Mayland replied. "They're out working. Or at least they'd better be."
"Oh, I hadn't thought of that, I guess."
Sparhawk and Kurek went back downstairs to the tavern.
"You want me to get our horses?" Kurek asked.
"No, let's walk.
People pay attention to mounted men."
"All right."
They went out through the city gate and on along the main road until they came to the wagon road Mayland had mentioned. Then they walked on down to the harbor. Shabby-looking sort of place, isn't it? Sparhawk noted, looking around at the settlement surrounding the harbor.
Waterfronts usually are, Keurig said. Let's ask a few questions.
He accosted a passerby who appeared to be a seagoing man.
We be looking for a ship as is bound for Thalesia,
he said, reverting to the sailor language he had used in Venny.
Tell me, mate, could you maybe tell us if there be a tavern hereabouts where the ship captains gather?
Try the Bell and Anchor, the sailor replied. It's that way a couple of streets, right near the water.
Thanks, mate.
Sparhawk and Keurig walked down toward the long wharves, jutting out into the dark, garbage-strewn waters of the Gulf of Assier. Keurig suddenly stopped.
Sparhawk, he said. Doesn't there seem to be something familiar about that ship out at the end of this wharf?
She does seem to have a familiar rake to her mast, doesn't she?
Sparhawk agreed.
Let's go have a closer look.
They walked a ways out on the wharf.
She's Camorian, Keurig advised.
How can you tell?
By the rigging and the slant of her mast.
You don't think.
Then Sparhawk broke off, looking incredulously at the vessel's name painted on her bow.
Well, I'll be, he said. That's Captain Sorgi's ship. What's he doing all the way up here?
Why don't we see if we can find him and ask him?
If it's really Sorgi and not just somebody who bought his ship from him, this could solve our problem.
Provided he plans to sail in the right direction.
Let's go find the Bell and Anchor.
Do you remember all the details of that story you told, Sorgi?
Enough to get by, I think.
The Bell and Anchor was a tidy, sedate tavern, as befitted a place frequented by ship captains. The taverns visited by common sailors tended to be rowdier and usually showed evidence of hard use. Sparhawk and Keurig entered and stood in the doorway looking around.
Over there,
Keurig said, pointing at a husky man with silver-shot curly hair drinking with a group of substantial-looking men at a table in the corner.
It's Sorgi, all right.
Sparhawk looked at the man who had conveyed them from Madel in Camoria to Cypria in Rendor, and nodded his agreement.
Let's drift over there, he said. It might be best if he saw us first.
They went across the room, doing their best to appear to be only casually looking around.
Why, strike me blind if it isn't Master Clough,
Sorgi exclaimed.
What are you doing up here in Deira? I thought you were going to stay down in Rendor until all those cousins got tired of looking for you.
Why, I believe it's Captain Sorgi,
Sparhawk said in mock astonishment to Keurig.
Join us, Master Clough,
Sorgi invited expansively.
Bring your man as well.
You're very kind, Captain,
Sparhawk murmured, taking a chair at the seaman's table.
What happened to you, my friend?
Sorgi asked. Sparhawk put on a mournful expression.
Somehow the cousins tracked me down, he said. I was lucky enough to see one of them in a street in Cypria before he saw me, and I bolted. I've been on the run ever since.
Sorgi laughed.
Master Clough here has a bit of a problem, he told his companions. He made the mistake of paying court to an heiress before he got a look at her face. The lady turned out to be remarkably ugly, and he ran away from her, screaming.
Well, I didn't exactly scream, Captain, Sparhawk said. I'll admit that my hair stood on end for a week or so, though.
Anyway, Sorgi continued, grinning broadly, as it turns out, the lady has a multitude of cousins, and they've been pursuing poor Master Clough for months now. If they catch him, they're going to drag him back and force him to marry her.
I think I'd rather kill myself first, Sparhawk said in a mournful tone of voice.
But what are you doing this far north, Captain? I thought you plied the Arshan Strait and the Inner Sea. I happened to be in the port of Zenga on the south coast of Camoria, Sorgi explained, and I ran across the opportunity to buy a cargo of satins and brocade. There's no market for that sort of merchandise in Rendor. They all wear those ugly black robes, you know. The best market for Camorian fabrics is in Thalesia. You wouldn't think so, considering the climate, but Thalesian ladies are passionate for satins and brocades.
I stand to make a tidy profit on the cargo.
Sparhawk felt a sudden surge of elation.
You're going to Thalesia, then?
He said.
Might you have room for some passengers?
Do you want to go to Thalesia, Master Clough?
Sorji asked with some surprise.
I want to go anywhere, Captain Sorji, Sparhawk told him in a desperate-sounding voice. I've got a group of those cousins no more than 2 days behind me. If I can get to Thalesia, maybe I can go up and hide in the mountains.
I'd be careful, my friend, one of the other captains advised.
There are robbers up in the mountains of Thalesia, not to mention the trolls.
I can outrun robbers, and trolls can't be any uglier than the lady in question, Sparhawk said, feigning a shudder.
What do you say, Captain Sorji? He pleaded. Will you help me out of my predicament again?
Same price?
Sorji asked shrewdly.
Anything, Sparhawk said in apparent desperation.
Done then, Master Clough. My ship is at the end of the third wharf down from here. We sail for Emsat with the morning tide.
I'll be there, Captain Sorji, Sparhawk promised. Now if you'll excuse us, my man and I have to go pack a few things.
He rose to his feet and extended his hand to the seaman.
You've saved me again, Captain, he said with genuine gratitude.
Then he and Curic quietly left the tavern.
Curic was frowning as they went back out into the street.
Do you get the feeling that somebody may be tampering with things? He asked.
How do you mean?
Isn't it peculiar that we just happened to run across Sorji again, the one man we can usually count on to help us? And isn't it even more peculiar that he just happens to be going to Thalesia, the one place we really want to go?
I think your imagination's getting away with you, Curic. You heard him. It's perfectly logical that he should be here.
But at just the right time for us to run across him?
That was a somewhat more troubling question.
We can ask Flute about it when we get back up to the city, he said.
You think she might be responsible?
Not really. But she's the only one I know of who might have been able to arrange something like this, although I doubt if even she could have managed it.
There was, however, no chance to speak with Flute when they returned to the loft above the seedy tavern, because a familiar figure sat across the table from Mayland. Large and grossly bearded and wearing a nondescript cloak, Platamy was busy haggling.
Sparhawk!
The huge man roared his greeting. Sparhawk stared at him in some astonishment.
What are you doing in Asye, Platamy?
Several things, actually, Platamy said.
Mayland and I always trade stolen jewelry. He sells what I steal in Simara, and I take what he steals around here back to Simara and sell it there.
People tend to recognize their own jewelry, and it's not always safe to sell things in the same town where you stole them.
This piece isn't worth what you're asking for it, Platamy,
Mayland said flatly, holding up a jewel-studded bracelet.
All right, make me an offer, Platamy suggested.
Another coincidence, Sparhawk?
Curic asked suspiciously.
We'll see, Sparhawk said. The Earl of Lenda's here in Asye, Sparhawk, Platamy said seriously. He's the closest thing to an honest man on the Royal Council, and he's attending some kind of conference at the palace. Something's afoot, and I want to know about it. I don't like surprises.
I can tell you what's going on, Sparhawk told him.
You can?
Platamy looked a little surprised.
If the price is right,
Sparhawk grinned.
Money?
No, a little more than that, I think. I sat in on the conference you mentioned.
You know about the war in Arsham, of course.
Naturally.
And what I tell you will go no further.
Platamy motioned Mayland away from the table, then looked closely at Sparhawk and grinned.
Only in the way of business, my friend.
This was not a particularly reassuring reply.
You've professed some degree of patriotism in the past, Sparhawk said carefully. I have those feelings from time to time, Platamy admitted grudgingly, as long as they don't interfere with honest profit.
All right. I need your cooperation.
What have you got in mind?
Platamy asked suspiciously.
My friends and I are seeking to restore Queen Alana to her throne. You have been for quite some time, Sparhawk. But can that pale little girl really manage a kingdom? I think she can, yes. And I'll be right behind her. That gives her a certain edge. What are you going to do about Lycaeus the Bastard? King Worgen wants to hang him. I don't normally approve of hangings, but in the case of Lycaeus, I'd make an exception. Do you think I could reach an accommodation with Alana? I wouldn't wager any money on it. Platymy grinned. It was worth a try, he said. Just tell my queen that I am her most faithful servant. She and I can work out the details later. You're a bad man, Platymy. I never pretended to be anything else. All right, Sparhawk, what do you need? I'll go along with you, up to a point. I need information more than anything. You know Colton? Your friend, of course. He's at the palace right now. Put on something that makes you look more or less respectable. Go there and ask for him. Make arrangements with him to pass on information. I gather that you have ways to pick up details about most of the things that are going on in the known world. Would you like to know what's going on in the Tamil Empire right now? Not really. I've got enough trouble here in Aosia at the moment. We'll deal with the Dairasian continent when the time comes. You're ambitious, my friend. Not really. For the moment, I just want our queen back on her throne. I'll settle for that, Platymy said. Anything to get rid of Lycaeus and Annius. We're all working in the same direction, then. Talk with Colton. He can set up ways for you to get information to him, and he'll pass it on to people who can use it. You're turning me into a spy, Sparhawk, Platymy said in a pained voice. It's at least as honorable a profession as thievery. I know. The only problem, though, is that I don't know how well it pays. Where are you going from here? We have to go to Thalesia. Worgen's own kingdom? After you just ran away from him? Sparhawk, you're either braver or stupider than I thought you were. You know that we slipped out of the palace then? Talon told me. Platymy thought a moment. You'll probably make port at Emsat, won't you? That's what our captain says. Talon, come here, Platymy called. What for? The boy replied flatly. Haven't you broken him of that habit yet, Sparhawk? Platymy asked sourly.
It was only for old time's sake, Platymy, Talon grinned.
Listen carefully, Platymy said to the boy. When you get to Emsat, look up a man named Strogan. He more or less runs things there, the same way I do in Simara and Malin does here in Asye. He'll be able to give you whatever help you'll need.
All right, Talon said.
You think of everything, don't you, Platymy? Sparhawk said. In my business, you sort of have to. People who don't tend to wind up dangling unpleasantly.
They reached the harbor shortly after sunrise the following morning, and after they had seen to the loading of the horses, they went on board.
You seem to have picked up another retainer, Master Clough, Captain Sorgi said to Sparhawk when he saw Talon.
My man's youngest son, Sparhawk replied truthfully.
Just as an indication of the friendship I bear you, Master Clough, there won't be any extra charge for the boy. Speaking of that, why don't we settle up before we set sail?
Sparhawk sighed and reached for his purse. There was a good following wind as they sailed out of the Gulf of Asye and around the promontory that lay to the north. Then they entered the Straits of Thalesia and left the land behind. Sparhawk stood on deck talking with Sorgi.
How long do you think it's going to take to get to Emsat? He asked the curly-haired seaman. We'll probably make port by noon tomorrow, Sorgi replied, if the wind holds. We'll furl sail and rig sea anchors tonight. I'm not as familiar with these waters as I am with the Inner Sea or the Arshan Strait, so I'd rather not take chances.
I like prudence in the captain of a ship I'm sailing on, Sparhawk told him. Oh, and speaking of prudence, do you imagine we might be able to find some secluded cove before we reach Emsat? Towns make me very nervous for some reason. Sorgi laughed.
You see those cousins around every corner, don't you, Master Clough? Is that why you're under arms?
Sorge looked meaningfully at Sparhawk's mail shirt and sword. A man in my circumstances can't be too careful.
We'll find you a cove, Master Clough. The coast of Thalesia is one long secluded cove. We'll find you a quiet beach and put you ashore so you can sneak north to visit the trolls without the inconvenience of having cousins dogging your heels.
I appreciate that, Captain Sorge.
You up there, Sorge bellowed to one of the sailors aloft. Look lively. You're up there to work, not to daydream.
Sparhawk walked a ways up the deck and leaned on the rail, idly watching the intensely blue rollers sparkling in the midday sun. Keurig's questions were still troubling him. Had the chance meetings with Sorge and Platamy indeed been coincidence? Why should they both have been in Assier at precisely the same time that Sparhawk and his friends had made good their escape from the palace? If Flute indeed could tamper with time, could she also reach out over tremendous distances to draw in people they needed at precisely the right moment? How powerful was she? Almost as if his thought had summoned her, Flute came up the companionway and looked around. Sparhawk crossed the deck to meet her.
I have a question or two for you, he said.
I thought you might have.
Did you have anything to do with bringing both Platamy and Sorge to Assier?
Not personally, no.
But you knew they'd be there.
It saves time when you deal with people who already know you, Sparhawk. I made some requests, and certain members of my family arranged the details.
You keep mentioning your family.
Just exactly... What on earth is that?
She exclaimed, pointing off to starboard. Sparhawk looked. A huge surging was just beneath the surface. And then a great flat tail burst up out of the water and crashed down, sending up a great cloud of spray.
A whale, I think, he said.
Do fish really get that big?
I don't think they're actually fish. At least that's what I've heard.
He's singing,
Flute said, clapping her hands in delight.
I don't hear anything.
You're not listening, Sparhawk.
She ran forward and leaned out over the bow of the ship.
Flute, he shouted. Be careful.
He rushed to the rail at the bow and took hold of her.
Stop that,
she said. She lifted the pipes to her lips, but a sudden lurch of the ship made her lose her grip on them, and they fell from her hands into the sea.
Oh, bother,
she said. Then she made a face.
Oh, well, you'll find out soon enough anyway.
Then she lifted her small face. The sound that came from her throat was the sound of those rude shepherd's pipes. Sparhawk was stunned. The pipes had been simply for show. What they had been hearing all along had been the sound of Flute's own voice. Her song soared out over the waves. The whale rose again and rolled slightly over on one side, his vast eye curious. Flute sang to him, her voice trilling. The enormous creature swam closer. And one of the sailors aloft shouted with alarm,
There be whales here, Captain Sorge!
And then there were other whales rising from the deep as if in response to the little girl's song. The ship rocked and bobbed in their surging wake as they gathered about the bow, sending huge clouds of mist from great blowholes in the tops of their heads. One sailor ran forward with a long boat hook, his eyes filled with panic.
Oh, don't be silly, Flute told him. They're only playing.
Flute, Sparhawk said in an awed voice, don't you think you should tell them to go home?
He realized even as he said it just how foolish it sounded. The whales were home.
But I like them, she protested. They're beautiful.
Yes, I know, but whales don't make very good pets. As soon as we get to Thalesia, I'll buy you a kitten instead. Please, Flute, say goodbye to your whales and make them go away. They're slowing us down.
Oh.
Her face was disappointed.
All right, I guess.
She lifted her voice again with a peculiar trilling sound of regret. The whales moved off, and then sounded, their vast flukes crashing against the surface of the sea, tearing it to frothy tatters. Sparhawk glanced around. The sailors were gaping open-mouthed at the little girl. Explanations at this point would be extremely difficult.
Why don't we go back to our cabin and have some lunch, he suggested.
All right,
she agreed.
Then she lifted her arms to him.
You can carry me if you'd like.
It was the quickest way to get her out from under the awed stares of Sorji's crew, so he picked her up and carried her to the companionway.
I really wish you wouldn't wear this,
she said, picking at his male shirt with one small fingernail.
It smells absolutely awful, you know.
In my business, it's sort of necessary. Protection, you understand.
There are other ways to protect yourself, Sparhawk, and they're not nearly so offensive.
When they reached the cabin, they found Sophronia sitting, pale-faced and shaken, with a ceremonial sword in her lap. Kurek, who looked a little wild about the eyes, hovered over her. It was Sir Garrod, Sparhawk, he said quietly. He walked right straight through the door, as if it wasn't even there, and gave his sword to Sophronia. Sparhawk felt a sharp wrench of pain. Garrod had been a friend. Then he straightened and sighed. If all went well, this would be the last sword Sophronia would be forced to bear. Flute, he said. Can you help her to sleep? The little girl nodded, her face grave. Sparhawk lifted Sophronia in his arms. She seemed to have almost no weight. He carried her to her bunk and gently laid her down. Flute came to the bunk and began to sing. It was a lullaby, such as one would sing to a small child. Sophronia sighed and closed her eyes. She'll need to rest, Sparhawk told Flute. It's going to be a long ride to Gwerig's cave. Keep her asleep until we reach the coast of Thalesia.
Of course, dear one.
They reached the Thalesian coast about noon of the following day, and Captain Sorji hove to in a small cove just to the west of the port city of Emsat. You have no idea of how much I appreciate your help, Captain, Sparhawk said to Sorji as he and the others were preparing to disembark.
My pleasure, Master Clough, Sorji told him. We bachelors need to stick together in these affairs.
Sparhawk grinned at him. The little group led their horses down a long gangway and out onto the beach. They mounted as the sailors were carefully maneuvering the ship out of the cove.
Do you want to go with me into Emsat?
Talon asked.
I have to go talk with Strogon.
I'd probably better not, Sparhawk said. Worgen might have had time to get a messenger to Emsat by now, and I'm fairly easy to describe. I'll go with him, Kurek volunteered. We're going to need supplies anyway. All right. Let's go back into the woods a ways and set up for the night first, though. They made camp in a small glade in the forest, and Kurek and Talon rode out about mid-afternoon. Sophronia was wan, and her face was drawn-looking as she sat by the fire, cradling Sir Garrod's sword. This is not going to be easy for you, I'm afraid, Sparhawk said regretfully. We're going to have to ride fast if we want to reach Gwerig's cave before he seals it up. Is there any way you could give me Garrod's sword? She shook her head.
No, dear one. You weren't present in the throne room. Only one of us who was there when we cast the spell can keep Garrod's sword.
I was afraid that might be the case. I guess I'd better see about some supper. It was about midnight when Kurek and Talon returned. Any problems? Sparhawk asked.
Nothing worth mentioning, Talon shrugged. Platamy's name opens all kinds of doors. Strogon told us that the countryside north of Emsat is infested with robbers, though. He's going to provide us with an armed escort and spare horses. The horses were my father's idea.
We can move faster if we change horses every hour or so, Kurek explained. Strogon's also going to send supplies along with the men who'll be riding with us.
You see how nice it is to have friends, Sparhawk?
Talon asked impudently. Sparhawk ignored that. Are Strogon's men going to come here? He asked.
No, Talon replied. Before sunrise, we'll meet them a mile or so up the road that runs north out of Emsat.
He looked around.
What's for supper? I'm starving.
Chapter 24 They rode out at first light, circled through the forest lying to the north of Emsat, and stopped not far from the north road. I hope this Strogon keeps his word, Kurek muttered to Talon. I've never been in Thalesia before, and I don't like the notion of riding into hostile country without knowing what's going on.
We can trust Strogon, father, Talon replied confidently. Thalesian thieves have this peculiar sense of honor.
It's the Camorrians you have to watch out for. They'd cheat themselves if they could figure out a way to make a profit out of it.
Sir Knight,
a soft voice said from back in the trees. Sparhawk immediately went for his sword.
There's no need of that, my lord, the voice said.
Strogan sent us.
There are robbers out there in the foothills, and he told us to get you safely past them.
Come out of the shadows, then, neighbor, Sparhawk said.
Neighbor? The man laughed. I like that. You have a very wide neighborhood, neighbor.
Most of the world lately, Sparhawk admitted.
Welcome to Thalesia, then, neighbor.
The man who rode out of the shadows had pale flaxen hair. He was clean-shaven and roughly dressed, and he carried a brutal-looking pike and had an axe slung to his saddle.
Strogan says you want to go north. We're to accompany you as far as Hade.
Will that work out? Sparhawk asked Flute.
Perfectly, she replied. We'll be leaving the road a mile or so beyond there.
You take orders from a child? The flaxen-haired man asked.
She knows the way to the place where we're going, Sparhawk shrugged. Never argue with your guide.
That's probably true, Sir Sparhawk. My name is Tell, if it makes any difference. I've got a dozen men and spare horses, along with the supplies your man Curic requested.
He rubbed one hand over his face.
This sort of baffles me, Sir Knight, he admitted. I've never seen Strogan so eager to accommodate a stranger.
Have you ever heard of Platamy?
Talon asked him. Tell looked at the boy sharply.
The chief down in Simara? He asked.
That's the one, Talon said. Strogan owes Platamy some favors, and I work for Platamy.
Oh, that explains it, I guess, Tell admitted. The day's wearing on, Sir Knight, he said to Sparhawk. Why don't we go to Hade?
Why don't we? Sparhawk agreed. Tell's men were all dressed in utilitarian Thalesian peasant garb, and they all carried weapons as if they knew how to use them. They were uniformly blonde and had the bleak faces of men with little concern for the politer amenities of life. When the sun came up, they increased their pace. Sparhawk knew that having Tell and his cutthroats along might slow them considerably, but he was grateful for the additional safety they provided for Sophronia and Flute. He had been more than a little concerned about their vulnerability in the event of an ambush in the mountains. They passed briefly through farm country, and neat farmsteads stood here and there along the road. An attack was unlikely in such well-populated country. The danger would come when they reached the mountains. They rode hard that day and covered considerable distance. They camped some distance from the road and left again early the following morning.
I'm starting to feel a little saddle-weary, Curic admitted as they set out at first light.
I thought you'd be used to it by now, Sparhawk said.
Sparhawk, we've been riding almost constantly for the last 6 months. I think I'm starting to wear out my saddle with my backside.
I'll buy you a new one.
So I can have all the entertainment of breaking it in. No thanks.
The country became more rolling, and they could clearly see the dark green mountains to the north now.
If I can make a suggestion, Sparhawk, Tell said, why don't we make camp before we get up into the hills? There are robbers up there, and a night attack could cause us some inconvenience. I doubt that they'd come down onto this plain, though.
Sparhawk had to admit that Tell was probably right, even though he chafed at the delay. The safety of Sophronia and Flute was of far more importance than any arbitrary time limits. They stopped for the night before the sunset, and took shelter in a shallow dell. Tell's men were very good at concealment, Sparhawk noticed. The next morning they waited for daylight before setting out.
All right, Tell said as they rode along at a trot. I know some of the fellows who hide up here in the mountains, and they've got some favorite places for their ambushes. I'll let you know when we start to get close to those places. The best way to get through them is to ride at a gallop. It takes people hiding in ambush by surprise, and they usually need a minute or two to get on their horses. We can be well past them before they can give chase.
How many of them are there likely to be? Sparhawk asked him.
About 20 or 30 altogether. They'll split up, though. They've got more than one place, and they'll probably want to cover them all.
Your plan isn't bad, Tell, Sparhawk said. But I think I've got a better one. We ride through the ambush at a gallop, the way you suggested, until they start to come after us. Then we turn on them. There's no point in letting them join forces with others farther up on the trail.
You're a bloodthirsty one, aren't you, Sparhawk?
I've got a friend from up here in Thalesia who keeps telling me that you should never leave live enemies behind you.
He may have a point there.
How did you learn so much about those fellows up here?
I used to be one of them.
But I got tired of sleeping out of doors in bad weather. That's when I went to MSAT and started working for Strogan. How far is it from here to Hade?
About 50 more leagues.
We can make it by the end of the week if we hurry along.
Good. Let's go, then.
They rode up into the mountain at a trot, keeping a wary eye on the trees and bushes at the side of the road.
Just ahead, Tell said quietly. That's one of their places. The road goes through a gap there.
Then let's ride, Sparhawk said. He led the way at the gap. They heard a startled shout from the top of the bluff on the left side of the road. A single man stood up there.
He's there alone, Tell shouted, looking back over his shoulder. He watches the road for travelers and then lights a fire to signal on up ahead.
Not this time he won't,
one of Tell's men growled, unslinging a longbow from across his back. He stopped his horse and smoothly shot an arrow at the lookout atop the bluff. The lookout doubled over when the arrow took him in the stomach and toppled off the bluff to lie motionless in the dusty road.
Good shot, Curick said.
Not too bad, the archer said modestly.
Do you think anyone heard him yell? Sparhawk asked Tell.
That depends on how close they are. They probably won't know what it meant, but a few of them might ride down here to investigate.
Let them,
the man with the bow said grimly. We'd better go a little slowly along here, Tell advised. It wouldn't do to go around a corner and come face to face with them.
You're very good at this, Tell, Sparhawk said.
Practice, Sparhawk, and I know the ground. I lived up here for more than 5 years. That's why Strogan sent me instead of somebody else. You'd better let me have a look around that bend in the road just ahead.
He slipped down off his horse and took his pike. He ran ahead at a crouch. Just before he reached the bend, he eased his way into the bushes and disappeared.
A moment later, he reappeared and made a few obscure gestures.
Three of them,
the man with the bow translated in a muted voice.
They're coming at a trot.
He set an arrow to his bowstring and raised the bow. Sparhawk drew his sword.
Guard Sophrania, he told Curick.
The first man around the bend toppled out of his saddle with an arrow in his throat. Sparhawk shook his reins and Farron charged. The two other men were staring at their fallen companion in blank amazement. Sparhawk cut one of them out of the saddle and the other turned to flee. Tell, however, stepped out of the bushes and drove his pike at an angle up into the man's body. The man gave a gurgling groan and fell from his horse.
Get the horses, Tell barked to his men. Don't let them get back to where the other brigands are hiding.
His men galloped after the fleeing horses and brought them back a few minutes later.
A nice piece of work, Tell said, pulling his pike free of the body lying in the road. No yelling, and none of them got away.
He rolled the body over with his foot.
I know this one, he said. Those other two must be new. The life expectancy of a highway robber isn't really very good, so Dorga has to find new recruits every so often.
Dorga? Sparhawk asked, dismounting.
He's the chief of this band. I never really cared for him very much. He's a little too self-important.
Let's drag these into the bushes, Sparhawk said. I'd rather not have the little girls see them.
All right.
After the bodies had been concealed, Sparhawk stepped back around the bend and signaled Sophrania and Curick to come on ahead. They rode on carefully.
This may be much easier than I'd thought, Tell said. I think they're splitting up into very small groups so they can watch more of the road. We should go into the woods a ways on the left side of the road just ahead. There's a rock slide coming down on the right side, and Dorga usually has a few archers there. Once we get past them, I'll send a few men around behind them to deal with them.
Is that really necessary? Sophrania asked.
I'm just following Sir Sparhawk's advice, lady, Tell said.
Don't leave live enemies behind you, particularly not ones armed with bows. I don't really need an arrow in my back, and neither do you. They rode into the woods before they reached the rock slide and continued at a very careful walk. One of Tell's men crept out to the edge of the trees and rejoined them a few minutes later.
Two of them, he reported quietly. They're about 50 paces up the slide.
Take a couple of men, Tell instructed. There's cover about 200 paces up ahead. You'll be able to get across the road there. Work your way up along the edge of the slide and get behind them. Try not to let them make any noise. The stubble-faced blonde cutthroat grinned, signaled to two of his companions, and rode on ahead. I'd forgotten how much fun this is, Tell said. At least in good weather. It's miserable in the winter, though. They had ridden perhaps half a mile past the slide when the three ruffians caught up with them. Any problems? Tell asked.
They were half asleep.
One of the men chuckled.
They're all the way asleep now.
Good. Tell looked around.
We can gallop for a ways now, Sparhawk. The roadsides are too open for ambushes for the next few miles.
They galloped until almost noon when they reached the crest of the ridge where Tell signaled for a halt.
The next part might be tricky, he told Sparhawk. The road runs down a ravine, and there's no way for us to work our way around it from this end. The place is one of Dorga's favorites, so he's likely to have quite a few men there. I'd say that the best thing for us to do is to go through it at a dead run. An archer has a little trouble shooting downhill at moving targets. At least I always did.
How far is it until we come out of the ravine?
About a mile.
And we'll be in plain sight all the way?
More or less, yes.
We don't have much choice, though, do we?
Not unless you want to wait until dark, and that would make the rest of the road to Hade twice as dangerous.
All right, Sparhawk decided. You know the country, so you lead the way. He unhooked his shield from his saddle horn and strapped it on his arm. Sifrania, you ride right beside me. I can cover you and Flute with the shield. Lead on, Tell.
Their plunging run down the ravine took the concealed brigands by surprise. Sparhawk heard a few startled shouts from the top of the ravine, and a single arrow fell far behind them.
Spread out, Tell shouted. Don't ride all clustered together.
They plunged on. More arrows came whizzing down into the ravine, dropping among them now. One arrow shattered on the shield that Sparhawk was holding protectively over Sifrania and Flute. He heard a muffled cry and glanced back. One of Tell's men was swaying in his saddle, his eyes filled with pain. Then he slumped over and fell heavily to the ground.
Keep going, Tell ordered. We're almost clear now.
The road ahead came out of the ravine, passed through a stretch of trees, and then curved along the side of a cliff that dropped steeply down into a gorge. A few more arrows arced down from the top of the ravine, but they were falling far behind now. They galloped through the stretch of trees and on out along the side of the cliff.
Keep going, Tell commanded again. Let them think we're going to run all the way through here.
They galloped on along the face of the cliff. Then the wide ledge upon which the road was built bent sharply inward to the point where the cliff face ended and the road ran steeply down into the forest again. End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.